All right, hi everyone. We're gonna get started. We've got quite a bit to get through today. My hope is that we can get through stuff relatively quickly. A lot of the things that we're touching on today build upon things we've learned throughout the course, and indeed, you know, that was sort of the idea with the deep dive in the Trans Mountain case, is it does touch on the Aboriginal administrative law intersection, but it also provides a review of some other concepts we've talked about. And so hopefully some of the things we get through will, you know, land more easily than they would earlier in the course. On this sort of wrapping up the course topic, obviously the exam is coming. There was some confusion about whether it was a take-home. It's definitely not a take-home exam. It's an in-class exam. Sorry if I said anything that misled anybody. Maybe the confusion was I will be giving a practice exam. Of a previous year's exam, I'll probably hand out two of them, but I'll tell you which one I'm going to go through in the class during the review sessions next week. And it would be a good idea if you have time, and I know time is scarce, to have a look through it, maybe try to do an outline. If you have extra time, you could write out your answer, certainly. And just see, you know, which issues you might miss that we'll talk about or being there, which ones you see. And to remember the kind of broad philosophy that I take to grading an exam, where it's one third issue spotting, one third setting out the proper approaches, the proper tests, and the, you know, the legal doctrines. And it's one third sort of showing a deep understanding of the course material. And some of the, you know, concepts we talked about within this Aboriginal section certainly can sometimes play into that a little bit. And some of the tying in the early parts of the course, the rule of law, these sort of ideas can certainly go to that component, as well as can, talking about anything that you feel unsettled with, or any things that you think might not be fully thought out properly. Those are the types of things that you know, if you can work into an answer, it can just help differentiate your exam from others, because there are, you know, 55 of them, and something that gives the reader a chance to really appreciate that you've dealt with this on a deep level does help push that exam to the next level. Any questions on the exam? All right. Well, certainly there will be, I'm sure, and we'll have two classes to really wrap up the course and talk about the exam. So if there's anything that's nagging in the back of your mind, certainly don't be afraid to raise it. Next week would be great. So today what I want to do is, first we're going to go through just a tiny bit more TMPX. We almost got right to the end. We didn't really tie off the consultation problem that was found to be sufficient to justify setting aside the decision. I touched on it but didn't quite land it, so I want to do that very quickly. We are next going to jump into the Gauthier Blueberry River case relatively quickly, but I wanted to do a case that illustrates federal court oversight of internal band governance matters. That's going to lead right into a discussion of federal court, and it's a bit disjointed because I'm going to go to federal court, then come back to do a kind of tying in final summation of the Aboriginal administrative law overlap, but I think that it should flow nicely the way I have it set up. And then we'll get into the delegation questions, and the delegation stuff is something I've taught much earlier in the course in the past, but the problem with doing it early is a lot of the concepts about review, etc., the review of a delegated regulation or something like that, it gets a little tricky until you've done the substantive review component of the course, so hopefully it'll land a little bit more easily now. We'll talk about the West Fraser Mills case. And that may not get done today. If not, we'll finish up the delegation next class, and then we'll get into the admin law and practice. So jumping right into it, finishing up Trans Mountain, we talked about the case, obviously, at some length, and talked about a couple of key interesting issues that we could illustrate with the videos. I spoke about the problem with the scoping, how it was attempted to be dealt with as a preliminary issue, how the Federal Court of Appeal declined to do so when it was asked before the whole process got underway to review the scoping, to review the question of whether marine shipping should have been considered part of the environmental assessment. That was found to be, by the court on the judicial review, to be a reviewable error, a fundamental problem, because as we spoke about at the end of last class, the failure to scope in the marine shipping, even though the panel did consider it with its own whole chapter, they didn't scope it properly within the environmental assessment part of their job. And by not doing so, they didn't get to this mandatory consideration of the Species at Risk Act. And there's some mitigation recommendations they were obliged to consider that they didn't put forward. And you'll recall there's that sort of strange, I think I called it legal jujitsu last class, where the court says we can't judicially review this report of the National Energy Board. We can only review the decision of the governor and council because that's what has actual legal effect. The report is just a recommendation. But they said the failure to properly scope the undertaking of the environmental assessment meant that the report that was handed to the governor and council was so fundamentally flawed that it didn't qualify as a report for the purposes of the statute, which meant the governor and council decision didn't follow the proper statutory procedure and therefore could be set aside. And in essence, what that is a workaround to allow the court to consider the full procedural fairness and the reasonableness of the report itself, despite it not being something that has independent legal effect. So they get to the place where, in essence, the whole panel process is looked at with the same level of care and scrutiny, just in the context of ultimately a review of the decision that has legal effect, which was that governor and council decision. So convoluted thing. I'm not going to ever draw that diagram on the board again. That was very complicated. But the basic idea that this was a complex process, which ended up with, you know, this problem with scoping rearing its head again after being not dealt with when the court had the first opportunity to do so, is one of the two pillars that was, you know, found to be shaky and ultimately resulted in the Federal Court of Appeal allowing the judicial review in the first instance and saying that there had to be more work done. The second problem was consultation. But what was interesting about this was it wasn't the consultation that occurred before the review panel itself that was found to be problematic. And this gets back to this idea I mentioned earlier that in discharging the duty to consult, the government is allowed to, the Crown is allowed to, use an administrative actor, an administrative process, like the National Energy Board hearing process, as a component of its fulfillment of the duty to consult. However, it doesn't just delegate away the duty to consult and say, okay, you fulfill it, you know, I can wipe my hands and be done with that. Rather, the obligation to ensure that there's been adequate consultation always stays with the Crown, and they have an overarching responsibility to ensure that adequate consultation on all facets of the process has occurred. So that does include reviewing the adequacy of the consultation that was accomplished at the panel process. So concerns around the way the National Energy Board itself dealt with First Nations groups and whether this process itself amounted to meaningful consultation were certainly live, were raised with the Federal Court of Appeal, and that process was found to itself be adequate. But there was an obligation on the Crown to not just rely on that process, but to also continue consultation after the National Energy Board process, and in particular, to engage in consultation on the report itself, to say, all right, this is the report that we're looking at, you know, what do you think of it? What are its shortcomings? What are its methodological flaws, maybe? What else would you like to say? What other things do we need to know in order to make a decision that's, you know, based on a full record of adequate consultation? And it is in this, they called it phase four consultation, consultation on the panel report itself, that the government was found to have fallen into error. And in essence, the problem that was identified was that the government did engage in this. They did ask the nations what they thought about the process. But the way they did that was they sent, you know, in essence, lower level government officials who acted as the court describes it, mere note takers. They went and they said, what are your problems? Okay, thank you. You know, I'll pass that up. What was missing, the court said, is somebody who could really engage in a dialogue, could really have the confidence of the governor and council, have the confidence of cabinet to go and represent that body in a real discussion with the First Nations. So it's not just a venting, it's not a blowing off steam. It's not just say your problems and we'll, you know, we'll put them in the hopper. It's let's actually get together and talk about this. So the court had this determination that what was needed was somebody with the confidence of counsel to go forward and speak with the nations to understand their concerns through a dialogue process, not a mere note-taking process. And that was, as I say, another basis upon which the Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity was set aside. The project was stopped, and further work had to be done. So to sort of put a postscript on this, what the government ended up doing was sending Supreme Court Justice, ex-Supreme Court Justice Frank Iacobucci. And he went out and spoke with nations, and it was more of a dialogue, and he was somebody seen more with this authority of cabinet, and he oversaw this process of consultation on the panel report. And that consultation, when it was reviewed again after the second time the governor and council approved the project, was found to be adequate by the court. So that sort of ties a bow on the Trans Mountain Pipeline process. But are there any questions about that case or that process I just spoke of? Okay. All right, so we're going to move on then away from the Trans Mountain Pipeline case. And again, I said last class, you can endlessly delve into this. It's, yeah, go ahead.
I've just got a question about the duty to consult the standard of review.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really deference for. But doesn't, can you explain how that kind of coincides with Babelog and saying constitutional questions need a correctness standard?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think a lot of people are very disappointed with the approach which has survived Babelog of saying that there is going to be some correctness within this consultation question, but not in all aspects. So where they've landed is to say, if the question is the existence and scope of an Aboriginal or treaty right, you have to be correct on that. They say that's the constitutional question that attracts correctness review. So if somebody were to say, well, you know, I don't really think there is an Aboriginal right at issue here, that question, that determination wouldn't get any deference. But they say when you're discharging the duty to consult, when you're actually going through the process of meeting understanding concerns, thinking about possible mitigation or accommodation measures. A reviewing court is going to give deference to how the government actually discharged the consultation, and it would have to be, in essence, unreasonable, an unreasonable approach to consultation to get overturned there. The criticism is sort of twofold. One is that it's not really how we seem to treat other constitutional rights in other contexts. The second is that there's something of a you lose twice dynamic here, because the actual standard that the duty to consult is measured against itself has a degree of deference and sort of, it doesn't have to be perfect consultation, it has to be adequate consultation, there's more than one way to do it. So you get a sort of deferential right, or a right that's got some limits to it, that you're only entitled to adequate consultation, not perfect consultation. And then in assessing whether that standard's been met, we'll defer to the decision maker. So the decision maker themselves says, it doesn't have to be perfect, only has to be adequate, this is good enough. Then the court says, well, the decision maker made a choice, this was good enough, and I'm going to defer to that. So it can feel quite deferential. So that's the tension, the problem, and there hasn't been any resolution that's really moved us forward from that post-Vavilov. That said, I am somewhat hopeful coming out of the case we read, I'm trying to blank on the Northern case about language rights, the Commission Scolaire, I think it is, where we saw the sort of minority Justice Cote approach to charter values seem to kind of carry the day despite the language of charter values remaining, and there's seeming to be very little room for ongoing deference when there's a charter right or value at stake. And I think that there's a good chance that that sort of an approach is going to be carried into this Aboriginal consultation context. So while the language of deference remains, I suspect that if a court feels that there hasn't been adequate consultation, there'll be very little room to say, well, we would have decided this was inadequate, but we're going to defer to this person who measured consultation earlier, or, you know, to defer to the decision maker. So what you've, I was just going to say, what you've hit upon is a really unsettled and, to me personally, a bit troubling area. And I'm not sure that there's, I think there will be some more movement in that space. Do you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, so just with, you started at the beginning saying that according to that law, like actually determining if there is a right or title, you need correctness for that. Tribunals can't decide on title and rights, then why would a court ever be reviewing that?
Yeah, no, that's a really, really good question. And we're getting pretty deep into this stuff. But so basically the idea is that when the Crown goes about assessing consultation, it is not obliged to resolve whether a right exists or not. If there's been an unproven right, nations had said, well, look, you are coming to my territory. You are going to do a project that I don't want. I have Aboriginal title, or I have an Aboriginal right here, and you need to accommodate that or just not do this project. And then the Crown would say, well, where's your proof you have Aboriginal rights here? Where's your proof you have Aboriginal title here? And a lot of nations say, well, I haven't gone through the process of actually proving it through a court case, but I have it, and it really ought to be on you to tell me I don't, in essence. And so the nations had said, well, courts, once we're in this process, Certainly now you can decide for yourselves that we have Aboriginal rights here, that we have Aboriginal title here. And the courts have said, no, in the absence of a full trial where everybody can say their piece, you know, we're not going to find the existence of Aboriginal rights or title within a judicial review. And they've also said, government decision makers, you don't have to yourselves decide on the existence of rights or title to make these decisions on consultation. Rather, if it's not been proven by the nation, you, the government, can treat it as still asserted, not yet proven. And us, when reviewing in a judicial review, aren't going to take on the question ourselves of whether it's been proven. So for the majority of nations, especially in BC, where there's a lot of uncertainty as to the scope of their rights, this leaves a really tricky situation where, yeah, you don't know, the courts won't let you use judicial review to prove your rights or title, and the government decision makers won't say whether you have rights or title, leaving you with the only option of going through the whole proof process, going through a trial, incredibly hard, incredibly difficult. However, there are a lot of places where there's a treaty or there's a proven Aboriginal right or title. And in those circumstances, it's not the same dynamic. So in those places, if you were to say, I interpret Treaty 8 as not covering this area, this part of the country, as an administrative decision maker, and you go to court, the court would say, hold on, you have to be correct on the bounds of this treaty. Or if there was an interpretation of the treaty, similar. You know, a lot of nations have modern land claims agreements. How you interpret those, that modern agreement would have to be done correctly. If there was a judicial determination you had rights or title, you'd have to understand that correctly. Like if they were to misunderstand what Silcotine granted, that would have to be done correctly. But where it hasn't been proven through a rights trial, title trial, or a treaty, that's where you have this unhappy situation where they won't engage with the existence of or scope of rights really in this judicial review, and you're left with the assertion of rights, and you're kind of dealt with on that basis. I wrote a factum on this point yesterday, so I filed it yesterday. Are there any other questions? That's a really good question. And that is getting, like, there's a balance between Aboriginal and administrative law in this course, and that's getting pretty deep into the Aboriginal side of things. And so if you don't have the background or if that didn't completely land, that's totally fine. But it's endlessly interesting. And my bias is there, but whenever you get deep into it, you tend to run into unsatisfying conclusions. All right, any other questions? Okay, so let's move into the Gauthier case. I'm gonna do this quickly. It's really illustrative of an instance where the federal court intervenes in a banned council governance dispute. What you had here is Blueberry River First Nations. And I imagine that you've studied the Yahe case in Aboriginal law now, or maybe you don't. You should if you don't. It's a really fascinating case from a couple years ago where the scope of Treaty 8 was interpreted in a really game-changing way for Treaty 8 nations, probably for historical Treaty nations all across Canada. It's brought by Blueberry River First Nations. It's the same band that's at issue here. But what you have here is a very discrete question of band governance. And this arises because of the structure of the governance that has been developed for Blueberry River First Nation by Blueberry River First Nation, but within the band council system, which is imposed pursuant to the Indian Act. And I spoke about that at the outside. I'm not going to go through that again in you know, any detail, but the basic idea is that under the Indian Act, there's the band council governance system, whereby band governance is done through elected officials. There's a band council election process the Indian Act sets out. There's also an option for nations to pass their own custom election codes and to set out their own governance structures, but that's still within the fundamental paradigm of the Indian Act. This is still the band council system, despite the processes being developed by the nations themselves. It's not any guarantee that this is going to closely adhere to what the hereditary leadership selection process might have been or traditional decision-making processes. You're still very much within an Indian Act imposed world. Blueberry River did pass their own custom election code. Blueberry River had some design over its own governance. And a problem arose whereby there was a hard split on council. So council for Blueberry River First Nations has five councillors, I should say. And there's also the chief. And each gets a vote, and that adds up to 6, and that leads to the obvious potential problem for deadlock. And what you had was 3 councillors who were very much sort of opposed to the governance of the Chief Yahe, and 2 councillors plus Chief Yahe who supported him. And there was underlying this some very serious allegations of criminality, of mismanagement of band funds, these sorts of things. So what had happened was the Chief Yahe group had in essence decided to stop holding band meetings, to stop holding band council meetings. They just never called them. The other group, the other 3 councillors, they were trying to put forward a report. You'll see this report in the decision. And what the report was something that attached signatures from, I forget the percentage, but 60, 65, 70% or something like that, of the membership of Blueberry River First Nation asking for an election because they had, in essence, problems with the way Chief Yahe was running the nation. So the Chief Yahe group says, you have to put forward this report at a meeting. We're not gonna have a meeting. You can't put forward the report then. Things went back and forth. It got a little bit messy. The 3 councillors attempted to hold a meeting, put forward the report, in essence, remove Chief Yahe from office. That was found to have been illegal. There wasn't quorum to do that. It was a nullity, in essence. And the Chief Yahe group had to go to the federal court to get certainty that that purported bound council resolution, you know, removing him from office, in essence, was not legally valid. But the other councillors after that said, well, what do? We have this deadlock. We have these signatures. We have this right to have this election coming out of this. We have important band council business that's just not being done. And it was COVID times. There was really important work for the community that needed to be done in order to, you know, adapt to the realities we were all dealing with at that period. So ultimately what they decided to do was to go to federal court, to ask the federal court to break the deadlock and to order meetings to occur. And that's the decision you have for today, to order meetings to occur and to order the process for consideration of this report and the signatures and the desire to move away, or the expressed desire for elections from the people who signed the petitions. You know, to get that moving was what came before the federal court. So One reason I have this case is because of the notion of here's an example of the federal court overseeing band council governance matters, one of the areas of Aboriginal administrative law overlap. Another reason I have this is there's an interesting distinction here between most of what we've been looking at, where this isn't a case of a discrete decision having been made that you could challenge and overturn. This is rather really a question of the absence of a decision, the absence of something happening that needed to happen. So this is in the nature of mandamus, if we talked about our old equitable writs. You see at paragraph 31 of the decision that this is not to review a decision, but to issue a mandatory order. You must hold meetings. You must table this report. Now, in that circumstance, our whole framework's a little bit different, because we're not really talking about deference anymore, because there isn't a decision to defer to. Rather, this is a case where the court is being asked to intervene to get something moving. And they set out the requirements for this sort of an application, again at paragraph 31, where they say the legal requirement is set forth as the establishment of a legal right, the inadequacy of damages, and the appropriate exercise of the court's discretion. So they say, look, you need to show me there's a legal right. You need to show me that this can't just be compensated with money. And you need to show me that there's an appropriate, that this is an appropriate place for the court to exercise its discretion. That is a kind of residual check on the appropriateness of the court intervening, which is especially appropriate, I would say, in these sort of First Nation governance issues, where there's a strong countercurrent of self-determination, self-governance, and the inherently difficult dynamic of the courts, the settler courts, interfering with internal band governance matters. However, in this case, the court said, you know, we do have jurisdiction. This court does have jurisdiction. And ultimately, that jurisdiction derives from the fact that the band council powers are provided through the Indian Act, which is federal legislation, and therefore within the jurisdiction of federal court. Now, you know, that's an area that you could spend a career, you know, thinking about the appropriateness of that whole setup. But the court didn't have much difficulty grappling with it here. There's a lot of jurisprudence saying that that is the way it works. And both sides agreed. And in fact, the Chief Yahe group had invoked the federal court jurisdiction to oversee the previous dispute I talked about, where the other group had passed some band council resolutions that were found to have been done without quorum. So both sides were, you know, contented that the federal court could oversee this sort of a band council dispute. And then the court went on to consider whether the test was met so as to entitle this group of counselors to get relief. And the court didn't have any difficulty in finding that there was a legal right to have band council meetings, or a legal right to have this report properly considered pursuant to the procedure that was set out in that Blueberry River Custom Election Code. Again, a code that was enacted pursuant to the Indian Act, but which sets out Blueberry River's own election and governance procedures. The main argument that they faced in response was an argument that may ring a bell from earlier in the course. It was a clean hands argument. It was to say, these counselors have misbehaved. and these counselors, therefore, should not be entitled to relief from this court. And that draws back in that underlying idea that whenever we're talking about judicial review, we are talking about an equitable jurisdiction, which is subject to the principles of equity, including that one who comes seeking equity must do equity, aka the clean hands defense, where you can say if someone's misconducted themselves in relation to the particular dispute at issue, that can be sufficient to disentitle them to equitable relief. Now, the court was not entirely happy with everything that the other counselors had done. However, it said that in these circumstances, there's a right, and that right fundamentally doesn't belong to these counselors. It belongs to the membership, who are entitled to a government that works, to a government that meets, to a government that follows its rules. And so the court wasn't very concerned about the conduct of these counselors disentitling relief here. They said, we need to break this logjam. We need to get this matter going. Follow the rules, have meetings, follow the rules with the report, made an order accordingly, and also said, I remain seized of this. And if there's a problem with this going forward, you don't file a new judicial review, you don't go to any judge of the federal court, you come back to me and I'll straighten it out. I think I saw a question. Did you have a question? Oh, all good, yeah. That did come up. They didn't hold meetings. Like, they just like continued not holding meetings. They went back to the federal court, and the first time around, there was no cost order for both sides. Second time around, there was a statement of, in essence, you're in contempt. I will find you in contempt and use the full powers of the court if this isn't cured right away, and you have to pay a significant amount of costs. But the big picture things to take away here are this idea of oversight of internal band council governance matters, so long as we're talking about Indian Act band council matters. If you were in the world of hereditary leadership, that doesn't have anything to do with band council system, it's unlikely you'd be able to go to the federal court or the BC Supreme Court for that matter. But to the extent you're dealing with band council matters, you're properly within the federal court. Any questions on that one? Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just wondering, so the court saying that there's no decision to defer to.
Mm-hmm. Hundred percent. Yeah, 100%.
So do you need to have a positive act then?
Is
that kind of should we defer that?
I mean, this could go either way. I think what you're getting at, I completely agree with the problem. And I've argued this case, so I remember writing this exact question out, putting it both ways, saying if there is a decision to not have meetings, a decision to not table this report, that decision's unreasonable. If there's not been a decision, then you need to order, that this stuff be done. And so is the absence of action a positive decision, or is it just, negligence or whatever it is? And I think that could turn on the facts. If there had been an order saying we are not having any meetings, that would have probably pushed it towards being framed the other way. In the absence of anything, any kind of legal act that you can point to, and just a kind of a nothingness, you're probably more likely going to be in the world of saying there's no decision here, it's a mandatory order. But you can frame it both ways, and you want to think about, your arguments on both sides if that were to come up in practice. Yeah, other questions? Yeah.
Absinthe where there is no decision, is establish a legal right so that it can't be compensated and that it's an appropriate place.
That's right.
Is the appropriate place question the jurisdiction question?
The appropriateness question is sort of it's a bit of a judicial catch-all. You could put a lot of things into that. The court did show itself to be alive to the sort of delicacy of court oversight of Indigenous self-governance. You could see a different circumstance where they'd say, listen, there's been a technical breach of your code, but I'm not sure that it really is prejudicing the membership too much, and I think you should try to work this out, and if you can't, come back to me maybe, but I'm not going to get involved at this point. Like, it could be any number of different things that could come out of that final test. That's a very flexible part of it. And it just basically lets the court, in essence, consider justiciability questions. Not that I can't do something, but should I do something here? So that's an area that there's a lot of room for discretion and advocacy if you're working for one of the two sides.
So if the chief had made a decision, would they review that on like a bad word?
100%, exactly. Yeah. If there had been a decision, it would be a reasonableness decision. A reasonableness review of that decision. Any other questions? These are really great. Okay. So what I'll do then is I'm going to use this as a segue to jump into federal court before we tie up Aboriginal administrative overlap. And so federal court had jurisdiction here because we're dealing with the power that is ultimately traceable to federal legislation. The federal parliament passed the Indian Act. The federal parliament set out certain powers of band councils. Federal Parliament set out a process by which a nation can adopt a custom election code that will be effective for band council, for the purpose of exercising band council powers under the Indian Act. All of that comes from federal legislation. And when you have federal legislation at issue and you're upset with a decision or the way that legislation is being administered, the review lies in federal court. I'm going to get to the sort of source of that now. And so that wasn't always the case. It used to be that the provincial superior courts had jurisdiction over federal decision makers. This comes from the notion that these provincial superior courts are these Section 96 courts, and these Section 96 courts have inherent and plenary jurisdiction. That's the idea that these courts have no limit on their jurisdiction, I'll get to the caveat in a second, theoretically no limit on their jurisdiction. There's no case they can't hear. There's no order they can't make. They're constrained only by, their notion of justiciability and their proper role in the constitutional structure. And the source of those Section 96 superior courts is the Constitution. It's really two provisions of the Constitution that act in tandem to create the Section 96 courts. Obviously, one of it is Section 96. The language of Section 96 isn't as explicit as you might think for something that's been given such a high precedence in our constitutional structure. Section 96 says the Governor General shall appoint the judges of the superior district and county courts in each province. Now, this certainly contemplates the existence of superior courts. But it also contemplates the existence of district and county courts, which have been abolished most places in Canada. So why is it that district and county courts can not even exist, whereas superior courts have this elevated a place in the structure where they're sort of part of the fundamental fabric of the Constitution. And that comes from the preamble. That comes from the idea that there'll be a constitution similar in principle to that of the United Kingdom. And that is where the notion of superior courts of plenary and inherent jurisdiction with no limits on their powers, that's where that idea comes from. So they say, look, if we're going to have something similar to the UK, we have to have these superior courts. That is a key part of the constitutional fabric. And look, Section 96 even explicitly contemplates them. So the courts have taken those two provisions, sort of rounded them out into a doctrine around the powers and duties of Section 96 courts, with the starting point of we can do anything, we can hear anything. Now, I said I'm going to give a caveat. There are two exceptions to that. The first exception stems from federalism. And it's the idea, well, there's lots of Section 96 courts across the country. So there has been a whole body of law built up around the jurisdictional limits of Section 96 courts and whether they can make orders that are effective outside of the province. Obviously, that's far beyond the scope of this course. Conflicts, you know, you probably have done some work on that in conflicts. There's broader questions of territoriality that apply to, you know, internationally, and whether, you know, a UK court can make an order that's effective in Canada, or how we're going to recognize and enforce foreign judgments. But because of federalism, some of these issues arise within Canada, not just in the international context. Again, that's the entire body of conflicts, and that's an excellent course to take if you haven't. So jurisdictional limits, you know, they come up a lot. And a lot of the work I do now is on national class actions, and that's one of the areas that you have a lot of fights, a lot of difficulty. You know, can we, I've spent most of last year thinking about whether BC can sue Quebec opioid producers in BC for damage done in Quebec. You know, it's a tricky question. Jurisdictional limits is one limit on Section 96 courts. The other limit on Section 96 courts is when Parliament has taken something away from them. And that's when you run into the tension between courts and their constitutional role and the supremacy of Parliament. And you have the idea there's no limit on what the courts can do, can order their jurisdiction. But there's also no limit on what Parliament can order and do through laws. When they pass a valid law, you know, their jurisdiction, or the jurisdiction of the federal and provincial parliaments together, under the notion of parliamentary supremacy, especially before the Constitution Act 1982, the idea was that they have absolute complete sovereignty, complete power. They can make or unmake any law they want whatsoever. So those two concepts, you can see the obvious tension. The way the courts have resolved that is to say, look, Parliament, you can take power away from us. However, you cannot take so much power away from us that you've changed our fundamental nature, that you've changed our fundamental role within the constitutional fabric. This is known as the Section 96 courts problem. It came up recently with respect to changes to the Civil Resolution Tribunal, which were found to have gone too far in taking away power from the BC Supreme Court. It comes up from time to time. I'm sure you talked about it in constitutional law. Again, a bit beyond the scope of this course, but I'm all winding up to where the federal court comes in. And so the federal court is sort of unique in being another body that can decide, adjudicate matters that is explicitly contemplated in the Constitution, but not necessitated by the Constitution. And this is Section 101 of the Constitution Act, 1867. And you see, the Parliament of Canada may, from time to time, provide for the constitution, maintenance, and organization of a General Court of Appeal for Canada. Just pausing there, that's the Supreme Court of Canada. That's the authority to make the Supreme Court of Canada. And for the establishment of any additional courts for the better administration of the laws of Canada. And that's what the federal court is. It's a court for the administration of the laws of Canada. And when you read the term Canada in the context of the Constitution, if you look at the way it's used in other provisions, it becomes clear that Canada means the federal branch of the division of powers. So it's the better administration of federal law that Section 101 contemplates. But for a long time, they quickly made a Supreme Court of Canada. Parliament quickly did that. But the federal court system didn't arise right away. And at first it arose through the Exchequer Court, which has a analog in England, which is, you know, basically revenue, basically tax court. But I forget exactly when. I think around the 60s, the parliament invoked Section 101 to pass the Federal Courts Act to create the federal court and the Federal Court of Appeal. So what I have on the board here is you want to think you have provincial administrative decisions and federal administrative decisions. And the default is that both of them could be reviewed by a Section 96 court. And I put the Section 96 court jurisdiction in sort of dashes just to remind you that it's really broad and amorphous and basically limitless in theory. So for a long time, if I had a problem with a federal decision, BC Supreme Court, it's fine. However, the Federal Courts Act passed by Parliament pursuant to Section 101 of the Constitution, creates the federal court, and in fact, puts a solid line around this in the sense that they say, you can only go to federal court when you want to judicially review a decision of a federal board, commission, or other tribunal. And this is the Federal Courts Act. And what the Federal Courts Act does in Section 18 is it speaks of exclusive jurisdiction. And it says the federal court has exclusive original jurisdiction to issue an injunction, a writ of certiorari, writ of prohibition, writ of mandamus, quo warranto, grant declaratory relief against any federal board, commission, or other tribunal. Now you got to be a lawyer to really understand what that means. But those are all the administrative law remedies we've been talking about. And this is exclusive jurisdiction. That means it's taken away from the provincial superior courts. 18.3 says these remedies may be obtained only on an application for judicial review made under Section 18.1. And then this sets out the broad power to bring an application for a judicial review. So, exclusive jurisdiction to issue the administrative law remedies against federal board, commissions, or other tribunals. I've shown you the definition of federal board, commission, or other tribunal previously, but it's exceptionally broad. Any body, person, or persons having, exercising, or purporting to exercise jurisdiction or powers conferred by or under an act of parliament or a prerogative of the crown. And remember, this was referred to earlier when I was trying to describe just how big the executive is. It's anybody exercising any power under any statutory authority or the prerogative of the crown. And so if it's federal statute, anybody exercising power under federal statute is a federal board, commission, or other tribunal. Now, they may not look like it. You may think you're just a fisheries officer out ticketing people who don't have licenses on the water, but you're a board, commissioner, or other tribunal when you do so. You know, any federal power that's being exercised pursuant to statute falls into this. Any problem that you have with that, that you want to invoke administrative law, Section 18 says is exclusive jurisdiction of the federal court and has to be done by a judicial review petition. So that's the jurisdiction of the federal courts. This actually probably is a good time to take the break, and I'll come back and just talk briefly about practice in federal court, because it's interesting and important to have some idea of the differences between the two streams that you may do. Then we'll wrap up the aboriginal administrative overlap and get in delegation a little bit. All right, so I'm just going to finish off the federal court now. And so we have the basic point about federal court is pretty, really straightforward. For your exam, this is the one you really want to have at your fingertips. I'll give you a statute that you're operating under, right? If it's in BC, if it's a BC statute, good to mention you're going to BC Supreme Court. If it's federal legislation, it's good to say you're going to federal court. That's sort of a threshold thing that really is important to know. The deeper things of the source of the jurisdiction, etc., that's unlikely to arise in the exam, to be totally honest. Briefly though, and this is also, not really going to likely be a big part of your exam, but is important to know, federal court versus BC Supreme Court, just in terms of what it's like to practice there, what these courts actually, can get done, is really important to know. First thing, you're going to go out and article practice, and most lawyers are going to be very scared, maybe that's an overstatement, but at least very unsure of federal court. Most lawyers don't end up going there in their career. You, in essence, have to do immigration law, maritime law, or do judicial review of federal decisions in order to land in federal court. If you work for the Department of Justice, you'll be there all the time. That's how I got so familiar with federal court. Over 6 years, I did a bunch of judicial reviews there. Since leaving the Department of Justice, I've gone there like 4 or 5 times, and I do an administrative law practice. So it's not a hugely, you don't end up going there all that often. That said, it's an extremely well-run court that has a lot of practical differences from the BC Supreme Court. I'm not going to go too deep into them, but just to kind of highlight what I like about federal court. Not what I like or what, but just so you know, it's in a strange place in Vancouver. So federal court is based out of Ottawa. The judges all have to live in Ottawa, but then they fly all over the country and they hear cases. It's, I think, a very difficult life, actually, to be a federal court judge. But they hear the cases in the Pacific Center. You go up an elevator to like the 7th to 9th floors, and the elevator opens up, and there's security. They do metal detectors, and they scan you and everything like that. And then you go into quite a nice courtroom, like a very nice courtroom with big windows overlooking the Hotel Georgia. I definitely looked over and been like, you should put clothes on over there. But the it's a very, very nice courtroom, very sparsely attended. In fact, sometimes they'll see a big Aboriginal case there with the busy courtroom, but usually it's completely empty. One of the times I saw people in the audience, I can't help but tell this story, they used to not have security there. And there was a guy who I had a self-represented person who chose to call the court up and ask if there was going to be security at the hearing. And they're like, well, now there is. So I showed up and there was, the guy, me, and these two extremely burly people with like the bulletproof vests like sticking out of their shirt, just like concerned citizens watching the court. Not really, clearly RCMP. But anyways, the court is sort of unlikely. You've walked past it a million times, been downtown, you wouldn't have noticed. It's in that black building. There's the TD Tower, and there's one that looks just like it across the street. That's where it is. So what I like about it so much, though, is not the location or the nice courtrooms. It's the process. And the process is very different from the BC Supreme Court in a couple key ways. One way is to start a judicial review in federal court. You file a piece of paper that's about like that. You just say, I want to judicially review this thing. To start a judicial review in BC Supreme Court, you have to put together a lengthy petition, your supporting affidavits. It can be a ton of work to get a judicial review started. Once you file your petition in federal, or sorry, your application for judicial review in federal court, you get what's called a Rule 317 request, where you can say to the decision maker, give me every piece of paper you considered. Give me the record that we're going to be arguing this thing on. They have to provide it to you. So instead of having to try to put together for yourself, okay, what were the submissions? What were the other side before? What was the evidence? Okay, try to get some stuff from the tribunal. Putting together the record in BC Supreme Court can be a real pain. In federal court, it just comes, a nice clump of paper. And if it's not in there, then I can argue, well, you didn't consider, you know, you should have had this in here, whatever it is. I get a record, it's nice and clean, I know what it's going to be. Then in federal court, you have to do a written argument. In BC Supreme Court, there's no rule that you have to do a written argument and no schedule for exchanging written arguments. So you know when you get a written argument quite often in BC Supreme Court? It's when you sit down in court and the other side gives you 50 pages to look through. That's not conducive to measured decision making. The other thing I like about federal court so much, two more things. One thing is they keep you to your deadlines. If you don't meet a deadline, you can consent with the other side to an extension that is 50% of the time period at issue. So say you had 30 days to do something, I can consent to another 15 days. Beyond that, I need a court order. Now that can be a pain, but the outcome of that is people just get stuff done more often than not. You know, I don't want to have to go to a motion, so I'm just going to get my thing done. I can move things around and get it done. Things move forward much more quickly. All right, two more things I like. Another thing I like is you get a case management judge almost all the time, somebody you can call to settle little disputes between you and the other side. BC Supreme Court, they're very reluctant to assign case management judges. Usually you have to go to chambers, sit in chambers, spend your day there. Whereas in federal courts, you can do a 10-minute call with the judge, get your thing sorted out. The final thing I like so much about federal court, and this shouldn't be underestimated, is the judges actually read your material before the court. When you go to BC Supreme Court, especially for a judicial review, very often, most of the time I would say, the judge has been assigned the file that morning, the night before. They have not looked at the material, and they come and sit down and they expect you to walk them through it. You know, fair enough for their, you know, from their position, but not very effective or efficient. Whereas in federal court, they fly out, they have their week worth of cases, they look through all of them. Inevitably, you go in, they say, I've read your materials, I don't need to hear about this and this, the thing I'm concerned about is this, this, and this. It focuses down the hearing, and so you can get so much more done so much more quickly in federal court. Whereas in BC Supreme Court, you gotta go through the whole thing. And also, you don't know the judge is going to have a lot of judicial review experience. In federal court, they all do. So there's a lot to be said for federal court. It's a very efficient, very well-run court, very underused. The problem is you have to have federal legislation at issue for the jurisdiction to exist. And so, you know, the opportunities are not always going to be there to get there. But it's a good court that people don't think about too much. And it's an interesting clerkship opportunity. Federal court clerkships are really interesting, exciting. All right. Any questions on federal court? Okay, that's kind of all I had to say on that one. The next thing is the Aboriginal Administrative Law Overlap sort of review. Now, what I want to be clear here is that this isn't really like a discrete area of law with, you know, discrete established tests that we need to. It's a little different from the way we looked at charter and procedural fairness, substantive review. What we have here is a body of administrative law coming into contact with a body of Aboriginal law, and there being unique issues and problems that arise as a result. So I think it's important to explore those difficulties, those questions, those tensions. I think it's also helpful to think through those big picture tensions I've been describing, because they help illuminate sort of broader questions of administrative law and their broader understanding of the subject. The specific things that we've kind of focused on, you know, we spoke about the sort of that underlying problem of the uncertainty of Crown sovereignty's basis vis-a-vis First Nations, that question of there's no doctrine of discovery, there's no terra nullius. So why exactly is the Crown sovereign over these nations? And we think about how that continues to resonate in the continued exercise of sovereignty over these nations, the executive making decisions that affect their interests, the judiciary, you know, interfering with their self-governance perhaps, legislature passing laws that affect their rights and interests. And I think that some coherency in that area is going to be tried to be achieved during your careers, and you know, we'll see how successful that is. So it's a tension that's important to be thinking about going in, I think. There's the broad problem that we talked about, and you know, moving on from that sort of foundational question, there's the broad problem of the laws that are at issue often giving broad discretion to the Crown with respect to First Nations, and that tying into the question of the rule of law and whether the rule of law can be properly maintained in the face of very broad discretion. And we talked about funding more broadly for social services, but we saw an example of funding more specifically for the costs of engaging in consultation, specifically the National Energy Board process. And we saw how even in the face of a very clear, coherent, cogent argument as to why funding was inadequate, the National Energy Board, in essence, ignored the issue, and the Federal Court of Appeal said, well, not enough nations have raised it, it can't be that important. Nobody was really willing to dive into the funding questions. So that tension persists. We've seen some positive movement where the legislation is a little bit more precise than it used to be, but still not very much. So that underlying tension is an important one to remember. We saw how the key portion of Crown Aboriginal relations at present is governed through the law around consultation. And here I just want to take a second to sort of think through our diagram and how these different issues sort of can resonate within this. And so when you think about the executive, a part of the executive, in theory, is the Indian Act Band Council, Indian Act Band Council system. You know, they just derive powers from the legislature, theoretically. They're another executive body with some unique features, but they're part of the executive. They get power from the legislature. They're overseen by the judiciary. Happens to be the federal judiciary because it's a federal source of power. So when you're trying to conceptualize that portion of the Aboriginal administrative overlap, it's within this diagram, within the executive. You know, what's special about this executive actor, and does this make sense? Is this the right way to approach this? Those are the bigger questions. Consultation, on the other hand, that's not really within this executive, at least the Aboriginal interest is not within this executive. This is the Aboriginal interest being affected by some kind of executive power. And there's some limited law around the idea of consultation on legislation. It's not really gone anywhere. Broadly, the whole duty to consult is about executive action that affects an asserted or proven Aboriginal right or title interest, treaty right. So duty to consult is about executive doing stuff which affects Aboriginal rights or title or treaty rights. So consultation is in essence a component of proper executive functioning, sort of an overarching duty that binds and affects any executive action that has that impact or that potential impact on Section 35 protected rights. So I just want you to, you know, have that different conception, you know, in your minds. And, you know, we saw how the courts are willing to intervene on consultation, inadequate consultation, send things back, strike down one of the biggest administrative processes, in part for lack of consultation. But we also explored some of the issues around deference here. You know, it gets complicated, but broadly the idea that it's going to be difficult to bring these consultation judicial reviews, that you're going to run into deference to the administrative actors and how they discharge their consultation. And this can leave First Nations in a position where they don't feel adequately consulted, don't have much recourse to the courts. All right, so that's kind of broadly what we talked about here. Are there any questions about the Aboriginal administrative overlap? All right, we'll come back to it in the review briefly too, but I want to take the time now to get into delegation. Delegation is something that we've been talking about for the entire course, because that's what administrative law is. It's the executive exercising powers that are given to them by the legislature. In essence, every power is delegated from the legislature. But that's not what we're talking about here in this particular part of the course. Here, we're more narrowly talking about delegated powers to set policies, either through regulations or soft law. We're talking about administrative rulemaking. And the book differentiates between rules and soft law, but notes that rules really means regulations. And fundamentally, regulations are exercises of a specific power provided through statute to pass a rule that's legally binding. So once a regulation is validly enacted, it's just as binding on everybody as would be a law. The nuance, though, and we're going to get there in a second, is how do you challenge a regulation? It's quite a bit different from challenging a law. And that puts you in the admin law frame. And that's what the West Fraser Mills case is about. Soft law is non-binding guidelines, procedural manuals, these sorts of other things that we've seen that administrative tribunals set out, which aren't regulations, don't have the force of law, but can become relevant for our course through legitimate expectations, if you'll remember. We'll expect people to follow these procedures generally. And which in practice really can affect how a tribunal goes about its business. They'll tend to follow their guidelines, you know, whether they really are fearful of a judicial review process or not. So when you come across something that looks like a rule, you want to ask yourself two main questions. What is it? Is it a regulation, legally binding? Or is it soft law, policy, guideline? How do you tell if it's a regulation? Well, it'll say it's a regulation. I mean, it'll have a citation to the, you know, the regulator, I'll put this, get this up. There's a specific way to write out regulations. So for example, the National Energy Board Rules of Practice and Procedure, that's a regulation. You'll see this kind of thing, SOR 95208. You know, you'll see it'll look something like this. It'll be a formal thing. It'll have a citation that will explain when the regulation was passed, what order passed that regulation, be published online. And, you know, on your exam, I'm not going to try to trick you. If it's a regulation, I'll say it's a regulation. You'll know it's a regulation. But that is the first question you want to ask yourself. Is this a regulation or is this just a guideline or a policy document? Because their legal nature really changes. If it's a regulation, it has to be followed unless you can challenge it by saying it wasn't validly enacted. If it's a soft law policy guideline, you'll expect it'll be followed, but you recognize that it might not be followed. That means there's some risk for your client if you want it to be followed. Or there's a potential to argue, well, you shouldn't follow it in these circumstances, you know, for this and this reason. So they're fundamentally different things that can look really similar. You know, but whether or not it's a regulation is the key distinguisher. So what is it? And if it's a regulation, is it valid? It's a key question to ask yourself. We're going to get to validity of regulations in a second, but overarching, when you see a delegated policy, a delegated rule that's been created by the tribunal, tribunal's created something that looks like a policy or a rule, what is this? Is this a regulation or is this some kind of soft law thing? If it's a regulation, is it valid? These are kind of key questions to have in mind. I'm going to quickly, following the book, touch back on some things we've talked about before. But, you know, in the particular rulemaking world, why do we see so much delegation of rulemaking authority? Why would Parliament not just make the rules, set them out in legislation? Why would it instead set out a pretty comprehensive but kind of broad and generic set of laws and have a whole lot of powers for individual executive decision makers to enact regulations to flesh out the details? And there's a number of good reasons and maybe some bad reasons why Parliament chooses to do it this way so often. Expertise is a great reason. There's some areas where it's just highly scientific, highly technical, or just you don't have experience in the area to know what works or doesn't. So we'd rather have the scientists determining the level of microplastics that are acceptable in this particular manufacturing process than we'd rather have Parliament, you know, trying to study and enact some law that, you know, wouldn't take place for years. So you can have expert, scientific, technical bodies who are going to have more knowledge and ability to better accomplish the overall goal of the statute by being more nimble with these regulations. You know, the second factor kind of jumps off that, time and information, that it's the Parliament may just not know what it needs to know to pass effective regulations, and sometimes need a regulation that can go into effect immediately. You need a minister or an administrative decision maker who's given a regulation making power to be able to say, oh, right away, this come across my desk, this is a problem, regulation goes into effect today. Obviously, that's not possible with Parliament. And also, another big feature of regulations is they're flexible. If you want to change a statute, it can be a hugely unwieldy process. Depends on the electoral winds when Parliament's sitting, other priorities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to change a regulation to nuance it, to tweak it, it can be done very easily, much more easily than changing a statute. And so there may be some ability to sort of calibrate regulations to better accomplish their goals by shifting their parameters a little bit. So those are good reasons to give a regulation-making power to an individual. And I just want to be totally clear that we're all on the same page. What you'll see in an act is a power that says the power to make regulations. And it'll say this person, the minister, you know, whoever it is, they can designate whoever they'd like, has the power to make regulations in respect of this, this, and this subject. We'll see one of those powers in a second when we get to West Fraser Mills. But that's the fundamental structure we're looking at. You give somebody a power to make a regulation, thinking about why you do that. Three good reasons, you know, expertise, time and information, and flexibility. Good reasons. The book talks about some bad reasons why it's also attractive to give regulation-making power. One of them it talks about is really interesting, maybe not a bad reason, but a bad sort of practical outcome from giving these regulation-making powers away. And they refer to it as a principal-agent problem. And it's the idea that sometimes when you as a principal give a task to an agent, sometimes your interests are not perfectly aligned. And the book has a good example that I think we all can intuitively understand of how sometimes a real estate agent isn't aligned with the interests of a homeowner. So you want to sell your house, and let's say you have a Vancouver house and it's worth $2 million. And the realtor is going to get whatever it is. Let's call it 10% of that, just to have a number. Right? Not 10%, sorry. Let's call it 2% of that. So the realtor stands to make whatever that is, $40,000 for selling the house. Now, if the realtor can get you an extra $10,000 with an extra 2 weeks worth of work, is that worth it to you? Yeah, hold on 2 weeks, get 10 grand in my pocket? Absolutely. Is that worth it to the realtor to do an extra 2 weeks of work for $200? No, like clearly not. So your interests aren't necessarily aligned in those circumstances. So there's any number of instances where you give a job to somebody else, but their personal interests don't align with the interests that animated you to give that person that job in the first place. The principal agent problem arises in regulation in this context when Parliament says, I have a task I want to give to this body. I want to give it to this body for these reasons. And the body starts to have their own conception, their own goals, their own ideas as to what they're trying to accomplish, and those don't necessarily align. And this gets into the idea, the next problem, of regulatory capture, which is the idea that sometimes people from a particular point of view sort of overtake an administrative agency. Quite often the problem arises innocently enough because you're looking for people with expertise to handle a difficult, maybe nuanced technical area. And quite often those people have worked in the industry in the area. If you want to regulate pipelines and you want to know somebody who's got a lot of experience in pipelines, where are you going to find them most likely? Probably working for a company that specializes in transportation of energy. What are those people going to want to do after they spend their time on the National Energy Board? Probably go back to work, probably at one of these companies. You start to have incentives that can align in a way that can swing a regulatory body to become favorable towards one side or another. This is the concept known as regulatory capture. And the book talks about the Ontario Securities Commission, which was really populated with securities traders. Now, what does a security trader want to do after the Ontario Securities Commission? They want to go back to a high-paying securities trading job. They don't want to ruffle a bunch of feathers, you know? And they may go in with good intentions, but there may be even subconscious incentives to, you know, to decide in a particular way. And there could be very explicit intentions. And, you know, if you've watched The Big Short or The Wolf of Wall Street, both those movies have really good illustrations of regulatory capture, where the person who's supposed to be watching out for the securities traders is actually trying to get a job there. Yeah.
I just want to clarify. So this whole principal agent problem, mm-hmm. This is more of like a way of conceptualizing it, right? It's like they're not especially the principal agency relationship, because then you're talking about like fiduciary duties and like.
100%. That's really well said. Yeah, there's law around principal agent, and that's very specific and nuanced. It's a way of conceptualizing it theoretically. It is parliament, and it is an administrative agency, and they're not principal agents. That is what they are. Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. Another thing that the book talks about is political cover, and we've talked about this previously, but it's the idea that sometimes parliament likes to give difficult decisions to an agency so that they can say, oh, it wasn't really my call. This was something that they decided upon. And I may not love it, but, they're the experts. We talked about that with the Trans Mountain Pipeline National Energy Board in particular. So I won't go over that in any more detail. But the bottom line here is that you have this dynamic where for good and slightly less good reasons, or for good and slightly less good actual practical outcomes, a lot of rule-making authority is given away from Parliament to administrative actors who exercise that by passing regulations. And as long as the processes followed, those regulations are valid unless you challenge them. So that's the kind of big picture framework that we're operating with then. And so the point that I want to finish with, and we're actually going to do good on time, I think I might be able to get through this, is what do you do when you do want to challenge a regulation? You do say there's been a problem with it. And what you have to argue is that the regulation is outside of the jurisdiction of the enacting body. Now, theoretically, you could raise this with the tribunal itself, but it's going to be a really hard sell. Most often, you're going to have to go to court. And you can go to court specifically just to challenge the regulation. You just bring a judicial review of what? Of the act of enacting this regulation. Or in the context of a broader court case, you can say, and by the way, that regulation's not validly enacted. So that can't be part of your analysis here. So you could bring it to the body, but most likely you're going to court. Most likely the body's not going to sort of self-defeat its own regulations. So you go to the court, and what are you faced with? Well, an uphill battle to say a regulation's been not validly enacted. And the main case on this is called Katz Group. It's referenced in West Fraser Mills, which is a nice summation and a more tidy case than Katz Group. But I want to quote a little bit from the Katz Group case. This is in the notes. And what the court says in Katz Group is regulations benefit from a presumption of validity. So starting point, I'm assuming it's valid. You've got to prove to me otherwise. Then they say the first thing is interpretation. You have to interpret both the regulation and the enabling legislation. So there's a provision that allows a regulation to be made. Interpret that broadly and interpret that purposively. That means thinking about the legislation's overarching purpose. How does that shape how I will interpret this regulation-making power? And I'm going to assume it's going to be a broad grant of power. Then interpret the regulation. Interpret it with that presumption of regularity. Interpret it in a way that's kind of most likely to be found within the power. If you can interpret it one way, that's really kind of crazy and inconsistent with the enacting power. Another more narrow way that seems more consistent with why this was granted, now you probably interpret it more narrowly to preserve its legality. Then they say this inquiry does not involve assessing the policy merits of the regulations to determine whether they are necessary, wise, or effective in practice. So you're not saying this is dumb, this isn't going to work, this is counterproductive. It's not about the wisdom, it's just about whether or not this is within the power that was granted to this administrative actor to pass regulations. And so the court says, the judicial review of regulations, as opposed to administrative decisions, is usually restricted to the grounds that they are inconsistent with the purpose of the statute, or that some condition precedent in the statute has not been observed. The motives for the regulation are irrelevant. So you just need to say this is inconsistent with the statutory purpose. Not that the government had some secret motive in passing this regulation, just that this doesn't have anything to do with the statutory purpose. And they go even farther, and they say, this is the key passage, regulations must be irrelevant, extraneous, or completely unrelated to the statutory purpose to be found to be ultra vires on that basis, on the basis of inconsistency with the statutory purpose. Irrelevant, extraneous, or completely unrelated. So if I have a regulation and I can't get to that level of saying this is irrelevant to your statutory purpose, completely unrelated, I'm very unlikely to have any success challenging the regulation. All right. That's the Katz Group case, and I want to get into the West Fraser Mills case now. We can get through this pretty briefly, I think. So West Fraser Mills is a case that involves a tragic accident, leaves a forest worker dead. You have a rotting tree that struck a worker in an area that was held under a license by West Fraser Mills. But the tree faller, the person who died, the deceased, was employed by an independent contractor, not West Fraser Mills. And this is often the case in these forestry tenures where you have somebody owns the tenure, somebody else is actually working the tenure, the owner hires the contractor to actually do the work. And so here we have the question about the validity of the regulation. And this is going to turn on, you know, the regulation making power and what its intended scope was. So the regulation making provision was section 225. And it said the board, the Workers' Compensation Board, may make regulations the board considers necessary or advisable in relation to occupational health and safety and occupational environment. Really broad. Workers' Compensation Board, you can make whatever regulations you want that are necessary and advisable, that you consider necessary and advisable, in relation to occupation, health, and safety, and occupational environment. So they pass a regulation that says, 26.2, the owner of a forestry operation must ensure that all activities of the forestry operation are both planned and conducted in a manner consistent with this regulation and with safe work practices acceptable to the board. And so generally, workers' compensation deals with employers, you know, the person who's actually on the ground doing, running the show. Now we're extending this one up to owners of the operation who may be fairly far removed. Now the owner's being, you know, argued to have some liability under this. And they're saying, hold on, workers' compensation, you deal with employer-employee relationships. You shouldn't be able to jump up and start to, you know, to hold the owners to account. But the court decided that this was an acceptable regulation. And they sent out, in paragraphs 10 through 12 is really the key part. They say, is section 26.2 a reasonable exercise of the board's delegated regulatory authority? And they go through that provision, they say, well look, the delegation of power to the board could not be broader. No limitation to just employer that I can find in that delegated power. And they say, from this broad and unrestricted delegation, we may conclude that any regulation that may reasonably be construed to be related to workplace health and safety is authorized by this section. Then they go on to say, determining whether the regulation at issue represents a reasonable exercise of the power is at its core an exercise in statutory interpretation, considering the text of the laws and also the purpose and context. And then they go on to cite Katz Group, saying the reviewing court must determine if the regulation is inconsistent with the objective of the enabling statute or the scope of the statutory mandate, to the point, for example, of being irrelevant, extraneous, or completely unrelated. Now, with this broad setup, is not a big surprise. The court goes on to find that this regulation, even extending it to an owner, is not completely unrelated, not extraneous to the whole idea of worker safety. And so, therefore, it is a valid exercise of regulation-making power. So far, so this component of the case, you know, the challenge is unsuccessful. So I'll wrap there. We got through quite a bit today. I will do like a high-level recap of this whole regulation and delegation component at the beginning of next class before getting into admin law and context, because that was pretty rushed. But hopefully the main ideas have landed, and we'll have a chance for any questions, you know, first thing on Friday. But otherwise, no readings for Friday, no readings anymore for the rest of the course. And we'll pick up on Friday and go through admin law and practice.